the water, but you can't make him drink. Send a fool to college, but you can't make him think. Some of us are strung out on TV, stone videos. Some of y'all keeping the village from having their own idiots. Some of us has never was, some has never has been. Some of us has never will be, some never gonna be again. Look, food for thought.
From New Orleans, that's composer, vocalist, and musician Dr. John with Food for Thought. And he spells it T-H-O-T, thought. It's from his 2001 album, Creole Moon. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and the president certainly gave us some food for thought last night in his final State of the Union address to the nation. Borrowing the oratorical framework of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's 1941 State of the Union Address, in which Roosevelt outlined four fundamental freedoms that should embody a global Bill of Rights: freedom of speech and worship, and freedom from want, and freedom from fear. President Obama, in his final address to the nation, outlined what he called four big questions that America must grapple with. Those questions being, how do we give everyone a fair shot at opportunity and security in this new economy? How do we make technology work for us and not against us, especially when it comes to solving urgent challenges like climate change? How do we give everyone a fair shot at opportunity and security in this new economy? And how do we keep America safe and lead the world without becoming its policeman? Well, I watched it. I forced myself. And I managed to go the full length with President Obama. And for the life of me, there wasn't very much that was enlightening here. There wasn't very much that the president actually laid out as a map. I think that was his point. He was not going to lay out a map for future action, just some general things to think about for whoever next will be president. And so the state, he says, of the Union is great. That's how he ended his speech. The State of the Union is great. Well, question number three took a bit more than 17 minutes to deal with, and that was a question of national security, because, of course, it is on national security that a lot of political currency is being hinged right now. People want to know, what is the United States going to do to assure its citizens that they are safe, especially from ISIS and counterterrorism, and safe from guns and safe from all of these things that comprise the overarching umbrella of terrorism? Well, I thought I would share the president's view, and we'll talk about that in particular and related issues related to the State of the Union address when we come back. But let's first hear this chunk having to do with national security.
Climate change is just one of many issues where our security is linked to the rest of the world. And that's why the third big question that we have to answer together is how to keep America safe and strong without either isolating ourselves or trying to nation build everywhere there's a problem. I told you earlier, all the talk of America's economic decline is political hot air. Well, so is all the rhetoric you hear about our enemies getting stronger and America getting weaker. Let me tell you something. The United States of America is the most powerful nation on earth. Period. Period. It's not even close. It's not even close. It's not even close. We spend more on our military than the next eight nations combined. Our troops are the finest fighting force in the history of the world. Nation attacks us directly or our allies because they know that's the path to ruin. Surveys show our standing around the world is higher than when I was elected to this office, and when it comes to every important international issue, people of the world do not look to Beijing or Moscow to lead, they call us. So, I think it's useful to level set here. Because when we don't make good decisions. Now, as someone who begins every day with an intelligence briefing, I know this is a dangerous time. But that's not primarily because of some looming superpower out there, and it's certainly not because of diminished American strength. In today's world, we're threatened less by evil empires and more by failing states. The Middle East is going through a transformation that will play out for a generation, rooted in conflicts that date back millennia. Economic headwinds are blowing in from a Chinese economy that is in significant transition. Even as their economy severely contracts, Russia is pouring resources in to prop up Ukraine and Syria, client states that they saw slipping away from their orbit. And the international system we built after World War II is now struggling to keep pace with this new reality. It's up to us, the United States of America, to help remake that system. And to do that well, it means that we've got to set priorities. Priority number one is protecting the American people and going after terrorist networks. Both al-Qaeda and now ISIL pose a direct threat to our people because in today's world, even a handful of terrorists who place no value on human life, including their own, can do a lot of damage. They use the Internet to poison the minds of individuals inside our country. Their actions undermine and destabilize our allies. We have to take them out. But as we focus on destroying ISIL, over-the-top claims that this is World War III just play into their hands. Masses of fighters on the back of pickup trucks, twisted souls plotting in apartments or garages, they pose an enormous danger to civilians. They have to be stopped. But they do not threaten our national existence. That is the story ISIL wants to tell. That's the kind of propaganda they use to recruit. We don't need to build them up to show that we're serious. And we sure don't need to push away vital allies in this fight by echoing the lie that ISIL is somehow representative of one of the world's largest religions. We just need to call them what they are, killers and fanatics, who have to be rooted out, hunted down, and destroyed. And that's exactly what we're doing. For more than a year, America has led a coalition of more than 60 countries to cut off ISIL's financing, disrupt their plots, stop the flow of terrorist fighters, and stamp out their vicious ideology. With nearly 10,000 airstrikes, we're taking out their leadership, their oil, their training camps, their weapons. We're training, arming, and supporting forces who are steadily reclaiming territory in Iraq and Syria. If this Congress is serious about winning this war and wants to send a message to our troops and the world, authorize the use of military force against ISIL. Take a vote. Take a vote. But the American people should know that with or without congressional action, ISIL will learn the same lessons as terrorists before them. If you doubt America's commitment, or mine, to see that justice is done, just ask Osama bin Laden. Ask the leader of al-Qaeda in Yemen, who was taken out last year, or the perpetrator of the Benghazi attacks, who sits in a prison cell. When you come after Americans, we go after you. And it may take time, but we have long memories, and our reach has no limits. Our foreign policy has to be focused on the threat from ISIL and al-Qaeda. But it can't stop there. For even without ISIL, even without al-Qaeda, instability will continue for decades in many parts of the world, in the Middle East, in Afghanistan and parts of Pakistan, in parts of Central America and Africa and Asia. Some of these places may become safe havens for new terrorist networks. Others will just fall victim to ethnic conflict or famine, feeding the next wave of refugees. The world will look to us to help solve these problems. And our answer needs to be more than tough talk or calls to carpet bomb civilians. That may work as a TV soundbite, but it doesn't pass muster on the world stage. We also can't try to take over and rebuild every country that falls into crisis, even if it's done with the best of intentions. That's not leadership. That's a recipe for quagmire, spilling American blood and treasure that ultimately will weaken us. It's the lesson of Vietnam. It's the lesson of Iraq, and we should have learned it by now. Fortunately, there is a smarter approach, a patient and disciplined strategy that uses every element of our national power. It says America will always act, alone if necessary, to protect our people and our allies. But on issues of global concern, we will mobilize the world to work with us and make sure other countries pull their own weight. That's our approach to conflicts like Syria, where we're partnering with local forces and leading international efforts to help that broken society pursue a lasting peace. That's why we built a global coalition with sanctions and principled diplomacy to prevent a nuclear-armed Iran. And as we speak, Iran has rolled back its nuclear program, shipped out its uranium stockpile, and the world has avoided another war. That's how we stopped the spread of Ebola in West Africa. Our military, our doctors, our development workers, they were heroic. They set up the platform that then allowed other countries to join in behind us and stamp out that epidemic. Hundreds of thousands, maybe a couple million lives were saved. That's how we forged a Trans-Pacific Partnership to open markets and protect workers and the environment and advance American leadership in Asia. It cuts 18,000 taxes on products made in America, which will then support more good jobs here in America. With TPP, China does not set the rules in that region. We do. You want to show our strength in this new century? Approve this agreement. Give us the tools to enforce it. It's the right thing to do. Let me give you another example. 50 years of isolating Cuba had failed to promote democracy. It set us back in Latin America. That's why we restored diplomatic relations, opened the door to travel and commerce, positioned ourselves to improve the lives of the Cuban people. So if you want to consolidate our leadership and credibility in the hemisphere, recognize that the Cold War is over. Lift the embargo. The point is, American leadership in the 21st century is not a choice between ignoring the rest of the world, except when we kill terrorists, or occupying and rebuilding whatever society is unraveling. Leadership means a wise application of military power and rallying the world behind causes that are right. It means seeing our foreign assistance as a part of our national security, not something separate, not charity. When we lead nearly 200 nations to the most ambitious agreement in history to fight climate change, yes, that helps vulnerable countries, but it also protects our kids. When we help Ukraine defend its democracy, or Colombia resolve a decades-long war, that strengthens the international order we depend on. When we help African countries feed their people and care for the sick, it's the right thing to do, and it prevents the next pandemic from reaching our shores. You know, right now we're on track to end the scourge of HIV/AIDS. That's within our grasp. And we have the chance to accomplish the same thing with malaria, something I'll be pushing this Congress to fund this year. That's American strength. That's American leadership. And that kind of leadership depends on the power of our example. That's why I will keep working to shut down the prison at Guantanamo. It is expensive, it is unnecessary, and it only serves as a recruitment brochure for our enemies. There's a better way. And that's why we need to reject any politics. Any politics that targets people because of race or religion. All right, let me just say this. This is not a matter of political correctness. This is a matter of understanding just what it is that makes us strong. The world respects us not just for our arsenal. It respects us for our diversity and our openness and the way we respect every faith. His Holiness Pope Francis told this body, from the very spot that I'm standing on tonight, that to imitate the hatred and violence of tyrants and murderers is the best way to take their place. When politicians insult Muslims, whether abroad or our fellow citizens, when a mosque is vandalized, or a kid is called names, that doesn't make us safer. That's not telling it like it is. It's just wrong. It diminishes us in the eyes of the world. It makes it harder to achieve our goals. It betrays who we are as a country. We the people. Our Constitution begins with those three simple words. Words we've come to recognize mean all the people, not just some. Words that insist we rise and fall together. That's how we might perfect our union.
Well, there you go. It's the President's State of the Union Address, in which, in this section, he addresses the issue of national security. I thought it was quite eye-opening because there seemed to be quite a lot of distance between his version of reality and what history and the facts suggest. What are your thoughts about this particular piece of the President's State of the Union Address? 888-874-4888. Incredible, incredible here. What was laid out before the nation. And I looked everywhere. I had not seen a very detailed analysis of what the President presented as the reality, and the reality that allows him to conclude that the state of the union is strong. That's what he says. The state of the union is strong, and here the matter of national security taking a huge chunk of his speech, this is what he presents as the rationale for the contention that the state of America is strong. I'm so troubled by this because certainly, you know, as we've discussed here on this program, how do you listen to a speech? It's not just a literal thing that is said, but one would believe that there's a reference point. There's a historical narrative that goes along with interpreting a speech, a context that allows a person to make sense of what is being said. Here's a president who is supposed to be portraying himself. He came into office, basically, saying that he will be ending the war in Iraq. He leaves the office, handing over any number of war-like initiatives to whoever is next. So many contradictions in what was said here. And the reason I selected question number three, the issue of national security, is that here the president does some really interesting fancy footwork, dismissing what he knows to be the facts about U.S. foreign policy, making no connection whatsoever to what we know are the facts, but speaking very much like a hawk, not the dove that he presents. Dave from Brooklyn, how are you? What are your thoughts?
Hi, Chris.
How are you? What did you hear or didn't you hear, or what did you hear that you differ with because you have an entirely different reference point?
Oh, absolutely entirely different. All I heard was, my sweet Lord, Bull. Everything was just propaganda. And you got the criminals all clapping along. As you said, he's pretty detached from reality for what he says, even though I'm sure he knows the facts. Because he's supposed to be this really intelligent guy from Harvard. It was all bull to me. It is about the crisis in Syria. Russia's the one who's been bombing. The tank is going to Turkey with the oil that they give the money to the ISIL or whoever the terrorists are. And no mention of that. That's my theory of the disconnect.
Is there one thing that stood out more than others in your mind?
I can't pinpoint one thing because it was all bull to me. And the criminals were all gung-ho. Everything's a hawk, everyone. Him, the rest of the criminals in the Congress. It's just very sad that this is presented to the people and most of the people are going to believe this bull.
All right, well, thank you for getting the conversation started today. Thanks for your contribution, David, from Brooklyn. 888-874-4888. A number of things were said here that, to my mind, are quite startling. And it should have been all over the news as the basis of discussion, not discussing, well, what did he say? How did he look? Did he sound confident? This is his last speech, and they basically gave him a pass on a number of things that were said that are directly contradictory to history and fact. And I was troubled that there was no uniform close inspection of what the president presented as his final State of the Union address. I marvel at this because the president was saying some very important things. Very important things. And so we have to ask some questions here. Is it that we are living an unreality and the rest of the world is real? Or is there something going on here that we're not getting? The media simply have not been critical or super analytical of this speech. From Philadelphia, Claire, you're on the air.
I want to tell you that a thought I had early this morning. Harvey from California calls you wonderful, Utrice, and I'd love to hear him say that because I agree. Okay. Thanks for letting me on. I wanted to say, I did not listen. I've only heard the feedback and some parts of it on recordings. But what stood out, there were so many lies. It was like lie after lie after lie. But the thing that stood out for me was when he said, we're the greatest nation in the world, period. Then he said, backing that up, we have more armaments than all the... That's the part.
Okay, go on.
We have more armaments than all the countries in the world. I'm thinking that's why we're in such trouble, don't you? What is wrong with you? What is wrong with the people who are flawed? That's the core of our problem, as far as I can see it.
We spend more on our military, he says, than the next eight nations combined. And people were flirting about that. That's such a great thing.
We have the greatest army in the history of the world. These are our hallmarks. These are our contributions. This is beyond sad.
And when he says that, is he not endorsing the fact? Is he not actually confirming the fact that the military industrial complex is what, in fact, is driving the economy, driving this global presence? Is he not doing that?
That's what they want. And he's their tool for getting it done. He's one of their tools for getting it done. It's all about destruction and power. That's it. And you know what bothered me more than what he said? The applause and the lack of critique today in any way, except listening to trends, of course. But, I mean, in the mainstream, virtually no critique. None. Not PRN. I mean, our NPR, whatever they call themselves now. I mean, the thing is, people, that bothers me most is the lack of understanding by most people.
Incredible. Thank you so much for your call today. We go to New York. Ali, you're next on the air.
Hi, Utrice. How are you doing?
Hello. Fine, thank you. Yeah. And you?
I'm doing well, thanks. But the first thing that I have to tell you is that the only reason that I hear those speeches is when I'm listening to your program and you replay them. Because why to listen to the things, most of the things that he talks about, they just, especially for that segment that you play, they were just pure lie. If we're so powerful and we have more arms, we produce more than the top eight countries together, how come we invaded especially two countries, actually three, with Libya, and we weren't able, we're still there, we didn't win anything, and we're so powerful? That is what is just like an unbelievable thing that this man talks about, how powerful this nation is. We are the most powerful. Don't think about China and Russia. They're just little people. But if we're so powerful and we wanted to crush them, how come this government, they don't go and try to invade those countries? No, we had to invade this country that we know that we could invade because we're going to crush the people. We're going to kill the majority of citizens there. But not only that, we cannot even win because we have to run out of those countries. We have to run away from them because they have people that they don't have a kind of arm, but they could fight us. So how come we're so powerful and we can't complete those jobs? Another thing that it bothered me about was the speech when he mentioned the Ebola virus. He said, if you listen to him, we win because we're so powerful. Our doctors, we were the first one there. And then he said, and then we let other countries, other nations, to join us.
Now,
let
who is he? Which country is he referring to as playing second fiddle?
I don't remember the country, but I know Cuba had been
there. Cuba is what he's referring to as among the other countries. Okay. Cuba was one of the first countries to respond.
Yeah. So
but according to the president, the United States was right up front, leading the charge against Ebola.
And we don't know if this Ebola virus has been a manufactured thing that they have done in here, in this country, how they did all the, they have manufactured all the viruses. You know what I'm talking about. I'm talking about that white powder that it went all around the nation and killed all these, especially people working in our post office.
The anthrax.
The anthrax, yes, exactly. So we don't know, but that was one line that he just killed me when he said we let other country to join us. It's like, you can join, you know why? We have to let you in. So it did bother me. That line just really bothered me because I just had to say this. I went to Bolivia and for the summer, this summer, and I went to a town where they had Cuban doctors working with the indigenous people. It's a very small town. Okay? So I just wanted to say, but he let them in. He let them in because we are leaders in the field.
He permitted their participation, yes. Thank you so much for your call. Is it Ernie from New York?
Hello, Yutris. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling in.
Yes.
What did you hear and what did you not hear?
Well, one thing that stuck in my mind that I couldn't listen to the rest because I was doing a lot of research on the internet is when he was talking about the children being our future and no one left behind. And I was thinking about when the lead program was cut, the CDC lead program was cut almost 90% during his fourth year being the administration, being president. And then it was restored again only through half. And I think that's a huge concern because here are all these kids that are getting exposed to toxin that could affect their future. Meanwhile, he's talking about no one left behind. Well, when you get exposed to lead, you could be left behind for a long time. My other issue with the military part of it is that just like no one can mess with the United States, no one can mess with Russia. And really, no one can mess with China. Russia has powerful nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapon that they have, a missile, is called the Satan. I'm sure people have heard about it, that have thousands of nuclear warheads, just one. And they have thousands of them. So how can we be talking like that, this gaullish kind of way? This is not the time to do that, Mr. President. We have to be a little bit more open-minded and come back to senility. I went to his inauguration 8 years ago when he became president and he got nominated. And his speech was great then, and I felt, but now I feel different. I don't feel like I felt back then. I thought he was, had something that was going to change the way, but the president has not. And here we are again. Thank you, Yutris.
Thank you, Ernie, for calling in today and contributing. From Chelsea, Melvin, you're on the air. Hello, Melvin? Okay. We don't hear Melvin. From Washington, D.C., Mike, you're on the air.
I knew I was going to follow Ernie. I knew it. I knew it. Good
You're
afternoon,
a psychic.
Lee. Good afternoon to you and your audience.
Thank you so much, Mike. What did you hear about this chunk pertaining to national security as presented by President Barack Obama that concerned you?
Well, the reason I said I knew I was going to follow Ernie because he ended up talking about all the change that Obama promised, and I was going to lead in by saying, look, Obama, he gave us all the hope. We got all the hope. He's pocketing all the change. Him and Michelle, they're pocketing all the change all the way to the bank, right?
Well, I like that one. That's good. He gave us hope, but he's pocketing the change. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Because think about it. What we're in right now, this is comical. It's comical because you're elucidating exactly what the rest of the public doesn't see, is that what we've got is green screen political theater. It's so far removed from reality that you almost have to be sedated in order to believe this crap. And most of the public obviously is, because it's like 50% of Americans are on antidepressants or some type of medication. So I guess that's why they can continue to get away with not even, the facts don't even matter. I mean, like, it's shameful what they can get away with. the facts don't even matter. Most people are so far detached from the reality of
what. All right, so give us an example, Mike.
I'll give you a perfect example.
Something that jumped out at you is, wait a minute.
He didn't just say that. I know everybody wants to focus on ISIL and, you know, what the media is telling you you should be afraid of, but I would think that what's going on in Ukraine right now is far more impactful than what's going on with ISIL.
Let's stay with ISIL a little bit. What is ISIL is a glaringly omitted from the president's speech about ISIL?
Well, I obviously didn't listen to the speech. I heard the snippet that you played, but I automatically know that the president is not going to talk about who is ISIL. He is not going to even flesh out where ISIL originated from, ISIL gets...
You're getting close, you're getting warm.
How ISIL even gets its armaments, how it gets its funding. He's not going to tell the American public that between our two biggest allies in that region, who? Saudi Arabia and Turkey, right? These are the main two entities that are responsible for keeping ISIL in business. How? Because ISIL is shipping oil from Iraq through Turkey into the market. That's how they're getting their funding, right?
You make an excellent point, and I thank you for that. But beyond this, what is the greatest omission here about Al-Qaeda and ISIL and terrorism and the United States?
This is all a figment. It's all created. It's not.
The fact is, what I'm trying to get at is, there is a direct link between Al-Qaeda and ISIL and the United States because these entities are byproducts of U.S. foreign policy.
We're speaking the same language.
When we hear this and you listen to the media today and everybody's just, you know, making nice and, well, you know, it's his last speech and everybody's clear that the purpose of his speech largely is to pave the way for Hillary Clinton to come behind him and hammer home the same points and pick up from where he leaves off. I mean, it is so offensive to anybody who has had any connection at all with recent history to listen to a speech like this and have it pass muster without any critique. Thank you, Melvin.
Ms. Lee, Mike.
One last thing.
I just wanted to acknowledge the passing of our dear elder sister, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. I know you've probably done that already, but I just want to continue to acknowledge the passing of this dear elder and great, because I know the mainstream media won't do that because they're too focused on David Bowie. But I want to make sure that we continue to acknowledge and give our due praise to our dear sister. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mike, for your call today and for contributing so meaningfully to this discussion. New Jersey, Michael, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Eutrice. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. Same here.
And with your audience, the PRN audience.
Thank you.
The most intelligent audience out there. Now,
thank you.
I think I was sort of ashamed to be part of this country. We're living here anyway. Because what he's done in this speech is reduced this country into a mere, military power. It was listening to that part that you played. It was like listening to professional wrestling, national boasting about our military power and how much stronger and what a bully we are, and that we can impose our will. He said, don't worry.
The language like, take them out.
Take them out.
Meaning assassinate and kill people.
Right.
Just take them out.
He sounded like an emperor.
Is this president speaking this way?
He sounded like an emperor, like the Roman emperor, roaring like a mighty lion with military power as a bully to impose our will and to insert ourselves right back into the Middle East, right in the middle of Iraq, where we came from. And he wants boots on the ground, and he wants a war, and he wants Congress to authorize it.
Correct.
To pay for it, and to once again have money, people running around with black bags of money in the middle of the Middle East.
What in particular
throwing our money out the window,
concerned
you
about his speech, Michael?
Well, I just think that there are so many problems. And firstly, I agree with you. I think basically this speech was an introduction to Hillary Clinton, and he was introducing sort of the programs that she's going to put in place, which are milquetoast kind of ideas that will have limited or no impact, and probably won't happen because Congress won't put it through, like taxing the rich, etc. These are little populist programs that I hear Hillary talking about now. The same thing, people over $1 million a year, the Warren Buffett rule, less than 150,000, like the 98% of the families, your taxes shouldn't go up. So it's a populist, and it's exactly the same things Hillary is saying on the circuit there. So,
well, the truth of it is, too, the president spoke as the titular head of the Democratic Party. He's not just the president of the United States. He's the titular head of the Democratic Party. And he spoke more as a representative of the party and what the party is, why the party should be elected and put back into office. And I thought it was an abominable thing to do, because in so many instances, the sideswipes that he took, at other Republican candidates were meant essentially to convey that the Democrats offered more, and certainly a more sensible approach to this question of national security, which is at the center of the Republican argument for election this presidential election year. So I thought it was really so sad that the statesman essentially reduced himself to a kind of a carnival barker, to say, hey, this is what the Democratic, he wasn't talking so much about himself, this is what the Democratic Party can do. Look, you want to know about international security? Why don't you ask Saddam Hussein? Yay, everybody's happy. What a cheap, cheap, cheap shot.
Right, I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's right on target. What he's doing is he's just, putting out the Democratic plank, and Hillary's, proposing. And he's just lining it up, turning the runway lights on, if you will. And this is what he sees as his job as part in this speech. And the other part of it is, this chest banging about, the military power, because he wants, to say the Democrats are really the neocons. I mean, he sounded like a neocon.
Of course. And of course, while you're at it, why not just approve the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
Absolutely.
We take that too away from the Republicans.
Absolutely.
We, the Democrats, we did that. Thanks so much, Michael, for your contribution today. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Melvin from Chelsea, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you for calling back. Now, what concerned you about this section of the speech?
It concerned me a great deal, and thank you for asking, that he has gave a license and clearing for a hawkish Hillary Clinton. He's given the dialogue and the conversation to have what my grandmother used to say, strong and wrong, still not right. And you
Correct.
Know this, Patrice.
Correct.
We as citizens, or so-called citizens, have been systematically compartmentalized into a debt credit slavery system since our grandparents were born, before our grandparents were born, during the bankruptcy of 1933, the Alien Registration Act of 1940, through the Federal Reserve Act of 1934, I believe. And now these things, these congressional acts, have caused so much damage to the American people that they don't know which way is up.
Is there anything in particular that you that profoundly offended you in just the excerpt, the 17-minute excerpt that we played today?
Yes, several things, profoundly, several things. But I would point out that he gave another license for your G.I. Joe commandos to come after anyone who had a garage, who looked who someone, a suspicious neighbor, would report you that you are a terrorist or you harboring ISIS. And meanwhile, you could be someone of color or sand-skinned, and you could be just hanging out with your friends who are of a different religious background, and you may have a neighbor who's a keyboard commando, and he's giving him license to call this person and say, I see suspicious behavior. And then you have a whole family disrupted or even shot dead.
Now, where did you get that from the speech?
Ah, contraire. You heard and you played it. It's so blatantly obvious. And he's so subtle about it. So subtle, so devious. He should be, I'm not going to go there, but he mentioned the part of those who are in their garages or basements who are suspected of being ISIS sympathizers and the whatnot. And we know this is not true. You know, in San Bernardino, or when that shooting took place, the original report was three white men, over 5'11", shooting at the people. Then the story turned into a Islamic or Muslim couple. Go figure.
So when you listen to this speech on national security, what, therefore, are you bracing yourself for based on what the president, in fact, has said?
I see more of a ramping up of our petrol dollar, which is declining because no one wants the petrol dollar, ramping up the petrol dollar to insensitize or to invigorate or to accelerate this global movement of this police state, financing various wars, Somalia, Libya, Gaddafi's gone, Yemen, Afghanistan, and moving, branching out, moving forward, consolidating these newfound territories, consolidating these newfound colonial territories, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and the other, and branching out to other areas, perhaps Turkey, perhaps...
Well, he said these are failed states, which should concern America more, but never makes the connection between U.S. policy and these so-called failed and failing states. He says, is what poses the greater threat to America now. It is not the polarity between East and West so much as it is these failed and failing states. And one says, well, wait a minute. There is a connection here. There's a common thread among these failed and failing states. It still comes back home. This chicken does come back to the foreign policy roost. And we do have to make that link. Thank you so much for your
You're
call
welcome.
Today.
May I say one thing? May I say
sure.
one thing, if I may? But these so-called failed states, it's the highest level of arrogance, is parading the double standard of the highest level of hubris to state another country's a failed state when you have dysfunctional states here in the United States who have people destitute, homeless. Are these failed states? Are these failed municipalities? Are these failed counties, Flint, Michigan, to Detroit, Philadelphia, New York? Come on.
As if they just decided, you know what, it's a good day to be a failed state. Let's just be that, as if there's no connection whatsoever. They just kind of decided to be failed states and failing states. Thank you for your call. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much, Melvin. That brings us to the end of our program today. Again, you all you have to do is just listen to the various levels of meaning in what people say. Here's a president making a speech that no major entity that I've seen so far has subjected to very close scrutiny and do some fact-checking and present at least a critique based on what has been established as fact. What is the president really presenting as his final State of the Union address? And is it, in fact, great, as he says? The State of the Union is great. So there you are, a great piece of public relations, a very subservient press, eating it up and spitting it back out at us, and we are expected to swallow this whole and believe, as the president would have us believe, that the State of the Union is great. Thank goodness for the fact that at least we can see from the calls that we had today, we have people who are thinking out there. And all we have to do is to continue growing the circle. Stay tuned. Coming up next is the NDC Savings Club. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know how you're thinking about these programs that we're doing lately. It's a pleasure always and a great privilege to be in your company. I sincerely mean that. We'll join each other again tomorrow. Until then, bye-bye.